My name's Alan. I'm a drunk.
Hey, Alan.
Ed's my sponsor. And I love Ed. I really do. We've been doing this deal now for about 12 years now. And you know, I came in, I'd sit in the back, and I'd shake, and I didn't know what to do. You know, I was drunk, you know, and I really didn't know what to do. Didn't know how to stay sober, didn't know how to live. And then the guy that was sponsoring me was sober enough to say, Alan, I got too many guys. You need to find someone else. And I had heard Ed speak. And he had just had a kid, his daughter, and I heard him say something, and then he didn't come back for like 2 or 3 weeks because he was babysitting or something. But then he came back, and I interviewed him, and he passed. And we've been doing the deal ever since. You know, I wouldn't have the quality of sobriety I have today. And it's just because of Ed and him doing and pushing me and getting into Big Book and getting into traditions and dragging me to meetings and getting me involved in service and really welcoming me into his family, too, because I'm over his house quite often. I live a mile away from him, which is really great. You know what I mean? I got anything going on. If he doesn't pick up the phone, I just bang on his door. And it's just that simple. Like I said, I love Ed Smith. You know, I really do. And you're in for a treat, because he's really got a really good story. He does the deal. And Ed?
I hope I can live up to that. My name's Ed, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey.
I'm the anonymous Ed Smith. tonight, my mission is to give you more of the message and less of the mess. Okay, because when I got here, I was a mess. Start off, I was born in a little town in upstate New York, March 21st, 1963. I consider myself I never expected to live this long, really. You know, so I've exceeded my own life expectancy. I think the beginning of my childhood was great. I grew up, you know, in a place where there was natural beauty everywhere, out in the country. You know, we had farms and we milked the cows, and we didn't own any cows, and we were the people that worked on the farm. And my stepfather was the drunk that worked on the farm. And eventually, you know, eventually what happened was, I forgot what I was going to say. Eventually what happened was he started drinking more and more, and we started moving from place to place, I think to stay a step ahead of the law. And eventually he left and never came back. So very early, I was kind of left to my own devices. You know, my mother was a single mother with 3 kids, and she didn't have time for the oldest, which was me. You know, so I was kind of, you know, ignored. And so as a result, I grew up kind of on my own ideas. You know, I made it up as I went along. You know, and I didn't. I didn't start drinking right away. I didn't have my first drink till I was 11. I needed one long before then. But at 11, we were, you know, we cleaned up after, you know, after everybody at the wedding, and you know, at the end of it, I ended up in the bathroom praying to that porcelain God that I came to know and love over the years. It wasn't really, and I didn't really start drinking until I was 12. So. Which I know is late for some people, but every chance I got, because I figured out that this when I drank, I felt better. I mean, it was just, I'd have a little bit of something, and I'd feel like, you know, happy. And that's all I ever wanted to do, was feel happy. You know, I didn't have anybody to tell me that, you know, adversity was part of life, and you get through adversity by doing this. You know, that's the kind of thing that I learned in AA. You know, when I got here, we had that talk. But for a long time, alcohol was my tool. I found a lot of other little tools to go in my toolbox, but alcohol was my big hitter. And it helped me get through high school. I had various jobs which all sold alcohol, and even when I was underage, I was able to, you know, bring my supply to school. And how I got through school, I don't know. I look at my report cards now, and I thought I was a pretty good student, and there's C's and B's and nothing that I want to see on my daughter's report card today, let's just say. And a lot of those needs improvements, you know, where they, and has behavioral issues, a lot of those little marks. But I did get out of high school, and I did pretty good in tests, and I did the test for the U.S. Air Force, and they put me into their computer school, which I was pretty happy about. They said, you can have whatever school you want. You scored X on this test. And I said, I want the, you know, and they put me into computer school for the missile control computers. And it was, half of my school went to Cheyenne Mountain and the other half went around the world. And I was set to go to Wiesbaden, Germany. But sometime during my training, alcohol caught up with me, and they found out I had this trouble showing up. And I would have this, I would disappear for 2 to 3 days at a time. And after a while, they said they were going to try to make it without me. And now the miracle that happened there, so I really think they took pity on me, because I ended up with an honorable discharge for what's called a 3910, marginal performance of duty. So they didn't really give me a black mark, but they said, here's your walking papers, and you go have a good life, and we don't need you anywhere near the missiles. So actually, they did give me a choice. I could resurface roads or take this honorable discharge, and I chose to take the honorable discharge. And started my career drinking and doing whatever came naturally, which mostly was stealing, drinking, stealing, and lying. Those were the three things I majored in. Something happened, right? And I got arrested a few times, which was no big deal. I mean, overnight. And I finally got this job. The training I got in the Air Force was just enough, so I had this, went through one of their best electronic schools. And I did very well. I got this job at this electronics firm, and it was really my dream job. My dream job was to be a technician in a research lab. So here I was working in for a company that made hologram equipment, okay, and I was the tech in the research lab. And they would send me out to places to do the installs, and I was going around the country at that time, and occasionally Canada, and I would put this equipment in. And it was a great thing I was a burgeoning alcoholic, I guess, at that time, because I was still showing up to work. And somewhere in the course of that, right at the end of my drinking, somewhere in that period I got married, which is another story. But and I married my drinking buddy. It's a perfect alcoholic wedding or marriage. She was the girl that walked up to me at closing time, sat on my lap, and asked me to buy her a drink. I was in love. And so we got married in 1988. And I was working for this company, living what really my dream, you know, because I really loved that whole technical, you know, research aspect. And I was sent to Baltimore, Maryland to put in some equipment. And I was supposed to be in New York the next day, and I was in Baltimore, and I got this idea in my head. I would go down to the Inner Harbor just to relax, because that's where you go to relax. And on my way back to my hotel, I drove a car into another car into some parked cars, and ended up in the jail there. And they held me for 48 hours, I guess, and didn't give me my phone call. They gave me a phone call, but it was only local. I didn't know anybody local, so I was off the map. And for the first time, my drinking came up on the radar. So I couldn't hide this. You know, here I was. Everybody's looking. Everybody, they were dragging the. They were calling the harbor patrol, asking if anybody was found dead in the harbor, because they thought I died, and I couldn't hide it. So I came back, and I tried to not drink so much, because at that time I was drinking every chance I got as much as I could, and you know, that's really what my life revolved around. So yeah, I was trying not to drink, and they would send me these places like Sheboygan, you know, Green Bay, you know, Montreal. These are great places. You know, Montreal, they got this special beer up there, which with a higher content of alcohol, right? And so on my last trip, they sent me to Milwaukee, and I loved Milwaukee. And the people in Milwaukee bought everything I wanted, and they partied like I did. And so I went to this guy's house, and I was not going to drink when I went to Milwaukee. I had 3 days in Milwaukee. And I was 3 days, no drinking. On the last day, the guy who was owned the company said, come on over to the house, we're having this video, a new comic, blah, blah, blah. And we all sat down, and he said, do you want a beer? And I said, no, thanks, I'm not drinking. He says, well, I'm going to have a beer. And I said, well, maybe just a gin and tonic. And without knowing it, I was in the book. Without a thought of what happened. You know, this was 6 months after I had been arrested in Baltimore. Without a thought of what happened, I started drinking. And I think I only had 2 drinks that night. And I came home, and my wife at the time, she had gotten this movie, Michael Keaton, Clean and Sober. And the writing was on the wall. I saw the movie, and for the first time in my life, I saw myself. You know, because I was doing what that guy did. You know, I had all the stuff, and I was drinking like a fish. Really, if I was feeling, I was on a mission to get to where I didn't feel again. And that's really what I wanted, was that not feeling. And the problem was, I always went way past the not feeling to the can't walk feeling. And then I'd get in my car and go somewhere and get arrested. But so I saw this Michael Keaton movie, and the next day I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Now, I had gone to alcohol. I don't call my, you know, the ones the lawyer sent me to. You know, what is it? This is a suggested program, and my lawyer suggested I come. Well, those were my first meetings. But the first meeting I actually came to was after seeing that. I went to this Wednesday night meeting at the Greek Orthodox Church in Danbury, Connecticut. And I walked in, and there's people dressed nicely, suit and tie. And I'm like, these people look too good to be drunks. And I walked up to a guy who looked like he was in charge, and I said, is this the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? He said, no. Meeting's been canceled tonight. We're having a church function tonight. And I was happy, because I was going to go get a six-pack of tall boys, sit up on the hill, and tell my wife how good the AA meeting was when I got home. And I go out to my car, and this car pulls up. This guy gets out, and he says, hey, man, you looking for the AA meeting? And I said, well, no, that's canceled tonight. And he says, well, I know where it is. And he turns around, and he tells this guy, his friends, he's going to show me where the meeting is, and he gets in my car. I am now, you know, I have this guy that I don't know. He's in my car, and he's out of his mind as far as I'm concerned. You know, he's looked pretty crazy to me. And his friends left. So now I got to take him to the A meeting. And he took me to this back alley in Danbury, Connecticut, to this place called the Drop-In Club, which was a storefront, really seedy-looking, dirty, you know, grimy place. And I loved it. I walked in, I sat next to the door, and I didn't talk to anybody, and I left. But I started going to those meetings, because I started going to beginner's meeting every week. And I think it was the second beginner's meeting I went to, because they only had one meeting a week, right? So I only went once a week. They only had one meeting a week there. So I went up to this meeting once a week, and the second meeting I went to, they sat around the circle, and they'd go around the circle, and they'd say something. And I had never said I was an alcoholic, because I didn't believe it. I'm just not, because I didn't have the trench coat, and I wasn't laying under the bridge and all that. I mean, I'd slept in the park before, but that was my own choice. I just didn't want to move home to my parents' house, so I decided to sleep in the park for 2 months. And but my point is, I went to this meeting, and they went around the thing, And I got to me and I said, my name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic, and I really need this program. And that's all I said. And the lady up in front perked up, and she said, honey, a lot of people need this program. If you don't want it, the door is right over there. And I felt like, you know, quarter inch tall, and I must have stayed sober at her for at least a year, you know, because that made me mad. I said, I'm going to show her that. And I, you know, on the way out the door, this guy grabbed me, and he started talking to me, and he started talking about sponsorship. And now, to me, sponsorship meant, you know, a couple of different things. You know, like if you're at the Elks Club, they tell everybody else you're okay, and you can be part of the club. Well, I knew I wasn't okay. So this guy's going to tell everybody I'm okay? It's going to happen because I know I'm not okay. And the other one is they pay for you to get in, they sponsor you, like Marlboro sponsors a NASCAR. You know, he was going to pay for me to get in the club. I didn't know what A was. So he said he was going to sponsor me, and all I had to do was call him. So I called him. And he said, come and pick me up. Now, what I didn't know is he was a five-time felon who had a lifetime revocation on his license, and he didn't have a car. So here I was. I went and picked up this guy, and I took him to the A meeting. Well, I started calling him, and he kept saying, pick me up. I'd come pick him up 2, 3, 4 times a week, take him to the A meeting. And we went to A meetings everywhere around Danbury, Connecticut. And we would get, I didn't really understand what was going on here, because he'd get in my car, and AA would come with him. And he would, and on the way, he didn't say much. You know, he let me, you know, ask him. So we go to the meeting, and in the beginning, it was like, we go to the meeting, they'd say stuff in the meeting, I'd ask him questions on the way home. And after a while, he started talking about this higher power working in his life. And I'm like, I heard that. I mean, they got that on the wall. One of those things I wasn't going to do was the third step. Because I took the, you know, I was doing it a la carte. I was doing the, you know, I got that one. I need that one. Oh, that one looks really, I really need that ninth step because that's where I go out and everybody loves me. And I didn't, and he started saying things to me like the steps are put in order for a reason. And he asked me a couple questions and told me to read the third step prayer. You know, and I was asking him about the, you know, how that worked. And how does this God stuff work? He says, hey, well, it's in the book. Go read that prayer every day. And it was as simple as that. And for guys that I talk to in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first three steps are two thoughts and a decision. That's, you know, 30 seconds for most people. You know, for us, I mean, it took me 90 days. So I'm a quick study. it took me 30 days to do that. It took me it took me a year and a little more to do the first five steps. And I don't recommend you take anywhere near that long because it's the old joke, when do we start working the steps? When we want to feel better. You know, and that's pretty much it. I get to, and it wasn't shortly after I started working the third step that I really started feeling something. And I didn't know it then, but I had just killed my chance of going back to drinking. Because my plan was to go in here, because my wife, of course, sent me to AA, go into AA, prove it wouldn't work, do everything right, prove it wouldn't work, and to go back to drinking. That was my plan. And it didn't work. Thank God. Because I went in and I started saying the prayer, and something happened. Now, what that something is different for everybody. Okay? But when I pray, something happens. And that happens every time I pray. It happens today. If I say a prayer, I said a prayer before I came here. Thank God. But prayer is the tool that I use the most. And this third step is probably the most important thing in my life. When I did the fourth and fifth step, and I've done them numerous times, every time I go through that process, I get to drag out some of the old garbage, but I always have to stay on that third step. The sixth step, you know, they put that, the sixth and seventh step are only like a paragraph or two in the book. They don't want you to see it. They don't want you to know what's there. Because that is where you say, God, rip out all my tools for living. You know, everything that I've used my whole life to keep you away from me is now going to be removed, and I'm going to be exposed as what I am, which is a human being, a God, a child of God. I have never wanted to be a child of God. I always wanted to be this big shot. I don't even know what I wanted to be, except I wanted to not be me. And what changed was I saw what I was doing, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And that was the bottom line. It made me painfully aware of my character defects. And thank God he didn't show them to me all at once, because I would have freaked out. He gave them to me one at a time. And usually he would bring some idiot in my life who was doing what I was doing that annoyed me. And I would see that what he's doing is annoying me, and he would show me my character defect. So that's the subtle way. And along the way, it has taught me how to love another person regardless of what they're doing. To love the person and separate them from their actions. You know, when the guy walks in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, he's not happy, joyous, and free. You know, he's miserable. Maybe he smells bad. You know, maybe he hasn't stopped drinking yet. Okay? I probably had some, you know, aroma when I came here. But my point is, you know, and I certainly looked bad. And I dressed bad. I dressed for you to stay away from me because I was afraid of you. Bottom line, this is the first room in my life I ever heard a man talk about fear. You know? And he was 6'4", 6'5". He probably weighed 260. He was an ex-lineman for the Denver Broncos. He's my second sponsor. But he talked about being afraid. And I'm like, that guy can't be afraid of anything. And how he got away from, how he handled his fear. And how did he handle his fear? He prayed. Well, there's this prayer thing again. So along about that time, and I'd done the five of the steps. I was working on 6 and 7. I was on my way to 8. I was about a year and a half sober. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And that's what he talked about. He talked about how to use prayer in your life. You know, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about how to use higher power. You know, I never had anybody teach me that, you know, this is what you do. They just said, go out and play and don't come back until dark. And it's pretty much it. I think what happened in there was it around the 8th step, I wrote down the list of everybody and we went over it. And I started talking to these people. I found out, I solidified the fact that I didn't want to act the way I was acting. The 9th step helped me be okay with everybody, regardless of how they accepted my, you know, not everybody accepted my amends. You know, I mean, the important people, thank God they did. You know, I mean, there was my cousin that I treated really badly on my wedding, first wedding day. There was my mother, you know, my father, you know, all the people that are really close to me. And I mean, the real fortunate thing for me was I was so into drinking that I divorced myself from pretty much everybody I knew and was alone. By the time I came here, there was nobody in my life, you know? So when I wrote down my 8-step amends list, there were maybe 10 people on it, because that's the only people I knew. And it's the only people I ever really had meaningful contact with. One person in particular, though, is important for me to remember, because he was a really good guy. And he was living in an adult assisted living program. And he started working for the company I worked for when I was drinking. And I did my best to get him fired, and it was my actions that actually I manipulated getting him removed from the company. So it was years later, I'm in a diner with my friend from AA, and we're having a nice breakfast. And this guy walks in, and I duck down behind my menu, and he says, "Well, Ed, what are you doing?" And I say, "See that guy over there? I don't want him to see me." And he said, "You know what you got to do?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't know what I..." Because at that time, I'm only working the fourth and fifth step at that time. And he says, "Well, you got to go talk to him. And you got to make your amends, because you're never going to know if you're going to see him again." And I went over, and we had a wonderful conversation. And that was the first amends I made. And it was the first experience I had with removing something that separated me from God. Because that's what it's about. Okay, this whole thing is about removing what separates me from God. Okay, and I'm doing the ninth step. In the tenth step, I take a look at what I've done every day, and I see what separates me from God. You know, where have my character defects overcome my what I would like to be? I can do it today. If I treat somebody badly, and that's my biggest character defect, how I treat others. Okay. If I treat another person badly, I have to go back and I have to make it right, or I'm not right. In the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous are one of my favorite parts and not often talked about. But, you know, the fact that, you know, you're a member when you say you are. I love that. Nobody can keep me out. Because if that wasn't there, I know how much of an idiot I am and how bad a person I am. I know I don't belong here to start with in my mind because, you know, I'm not okay. So I was able to say I'm a member because I want to be. And no one could keep me out. The ninth tradition in the book, and I forgot my book today, but my favorite part in that ninth tradition is where it says, "Great suffering and great love are A's, disciplinarians. We need no others." You know, why do I do this? Because I've proven that if I don't do it, I suffer. That takes all the altruism out of my life. You know, I do it. You know, if I do these things, I get love in my life. I get people like Al sent to me on a silver platter to keep me sober. If in my group, if you want to sponsor somebody, get between me and the door, because I'm getting every guy that comes in there, you know, because they are the reason I am who I am today. Every guy that, you know, the first five guys I sponsored, my sponsor was beautiful. He had 4.5 years when I met him, and I thought he'd stay, you know, that was like forever. I mean, how did anybody stay sober 4.5 years? And he used to go and talk to anybody. He would talk to anybody. Didn't matter what they looked like, what they smelled like. And so he'd get me to get the guy a cup of coffee, and after a while he'd say, "Ed, go talk to him." Or go talk to, and I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I'm not that way. And I told him, I said, "Charlie, I hate all these people." He said, "What I want you to do is every meeting you go to, I want you to go around and shake every man's hand in the room before the meeting starts." And I started doing that. I didn't like any of them. Now, at the end of doing that, he would send me to the guys that he pointed out and say, "Go talk to him," or "Go talk to him." And it was the new guys. And what happened was a couple of them asked me to sponsor them because they figured I was sober. I didn't tell them any different. I was certainly soberer than they were because I was there and they had just walked in. So I had a couple minutes on them. And so after about a year of doing this, I'm like, "Charlie, this, you know, what am I doing? I mean, what am I doing wrong? I have sponsored five guys and they all went out drinking." And he said the famous words. He said, "Ed, but you haven't." So that is it. You know, my life depends on the guy that walks through that door. The quality of my life, which today exceeds my wildest dreams, depends on the guy that walks through that door. Now, does it depend on that guy staying sober? No! And I tell him up front, it shocks him sometimes. I say, look, you drink, you not don't drink. It doesn't matter to me, but if you want to live, you come with me. If you want to die, there's death waiting. God bless you, man. I got no qualms with anybody. I do not want to stand in between anybody and their last drink. And I firmly believe nobody gets here early. You know, and you get to choose what the price you pay for that seat is. You know? I had guys, I'm glad I got some napkins before I came. I had at a clubhouse, at a clubhouse I was going to, which will remain nameless, there were these guys that, I mean, literally somebody put names on the seats. And I would go in there and I would sit in their seat. Because I paid for it. And they would walk in and they would say, that's my seat. And I said, would say to them, I paid for this seat and you are not moving me from it. Now, that's not exactly spiritual, but I did it because I felt that way at the time. And that was part of the evolution. See, the great thing about this whole prayer thing is God is patient. God is patient. If I keep asking God to show me what he wants to do, eventually I will get the message. You know? And he always gives me the message. He always lays down, you know, he sends people into my life that show me, maybe he sends some people to show me what I don't want to be, but he sends a lot of people in my life who show me what I do want to be. Most of those people I find in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, those are the people that have that freedom of being themselves. See, I could never stand up here and say this stuff to you before because I would think you would think whatever you're thinking about me, and I would worry about that. Today, I don't care what you think about me. What's important to me is I'm standing here as a representative of Alcoholics Anonymous saying that I used to feel awful, and I worked these steps, and now I feel elation. I feel joy. I feel, it's the old joke, Cody, hey, you start working the steps, you're going to feel better. Well, what they don't tell you is you're going to feel everything better. So you feel the crap, you know, a lot more, but you also feel the joy. If you're keeping yourself from feeling like crap, you're also keeping yourself from feeling the joy. Okay? And today I get a lot more joy because I've walked through all the garbage. You know, that's what 6 and 7, 8 and 9 helped me do. Let's take the garbage out of the room. Okay, so you have room for, now today, my room is full with people. You know, people like Al, people like my family. You know, people that I can have a relationship with and not worry about what they think about me because, you know, I'm following the principles that are in the steps. When I was a small child, my grandfather would take us and he would turn off the lights of his car at the top of this very large hill, and we would coast down about 3 big humps, total blackness. And it was exciting. It was like the poor man's roller coaster. and me and my brother would sit up in the back window looking at the stars when he was doing this, so no seatbelts, right? And my prayer to God was, I just want to be happy. You know, and that's all I ever wanted in my life was to be happy. You know, so what God did is he said, you're going to be an alcoholic. You're going to go through all this pain, all this misery. Then you're going to end up in AA, and you are going to be forced to do these steps or die. And as a result of that, you're going to have this wonderful life. Now, if you told me that when I was saying that prayer, I might have said a different prayer. But the point is, that's what happened. You know, and that's what happens to anyone I see come into AA, and that is one of the great joys of my life. I see someone that comes into AA, like Al. Al shook for 2.5 years. 2.5 years. And one day he didn't shake. And I got to witness that, you know? I sponsored a guy years ago, and he disappeared, and I didn't know where he went. And I saw him, this is about 5 years ago, and I saw him. He had moved out of town, and he's been sober since. I didn't have to have any part in that. All I was doing is what Charlie did for me. This is a book. We got 12 steps. You do this, good things happen. And I can't tell you how much it means to me. You know, I mean, just for the record, that night in Milwaukee was September 28th, 1989. Okay. And I never intended that to be my last drink. That was a pretty wimpy way to go out. 2 gin and tonics, you know. But my point is, I'm so happy. I'm so happy it happened like that. Because I felt so miserable. Just that I saw for the first time that I couldn't not drink. And I would have never believed it. It took every drink I took in order to prove that to me. And I can only hope that you all have that experience. You know, if you're here new, you don't have to go back to drinking. I see guys coming in, they get white chip after white chip after white chip. You can come in and stay. I came in and I planned to go out. I never picked up a white chip. My first chip, my sponsor gave me a 6-month brass medallion. You know, all they do up there is on your date, he's staying up and he says, "Ed's got 6 months, here's your medallion." And that's it. I didn't want to stay. But what I found when I got here was so good, I couldn't leave. And that's really what happened. So, I mean, I hope you can do something with that. And I thank you all for listening. I love you.